Now he had Joe's tooth in his pocket. When Michael got home, he washed it and turned it over and over. He looked at the roots and the shine and all the gentle wear of 4 years' bite, nibble and grind. In his mind, he converted it into coin.
Getting into the water is the easy part. Getting out again without running into a police officer is more complicated.
Things off today with some science. And if you're an actual scientist, you will probably roll your eyes at this complete oversimplification of atomic physics, but hear us out. Everything around us and within us is made up of tiny moving particles that are constantly attracting, repelling, and bumping into one another. Every surface in our atmosphere is repeatedly hit hundreds of millions of times a second by colliding atoms, from the sea to our city streets, to our very own skin. Sometimes these particles are relatively unscathed by those they crash into, and sometimes they're completely changed. So you could say that collision gives us life, and at times, some excellent stories. You're listening to All the Best, I'm Jess Hamilton, and today we're talking about things that repeatedly collide. In scientific terms, a collision is defined as an event in which two or more bodies exert forces on each other, causing a change of motion. The most poetic Wikipedia article I've ever read describes it as an insect touching its antenna to the leaf of a plant, or a cat delicately walking through grass. We're dipping into our archives this week to bring you two stories of forces coming together, like a hard wooden cricket bat and a mouthful of baby teeth. Or our first story, which takes place on the front line of a battle between two passionate groups in duck hunting season. Just a heads up, some bad language in this story.
On the opening weekend of duck hunting season, a group of recreational shooters and a coalition of people opposed to native bird shooting converge on a lake in Victoria. Both sides are 100% convinced they're right. They believe in their cause so passionately that they wake up at 4 in the morning and wade into icy water and stand there for hours. One half of them shoot the native wildlife and the other half get in the way. They've met on this lake to clash every year for the last 30. The leader of the group is a guy named Laurie Levy. You would probably recognise him. He's on the news every year. He was a cameraman back in the 70s when he got involved in the whale protection movement.
So the whales were about 5 tonnes. They were pilot whales mainly. And we used to put them onto the backs of four-wheel drive trucks.
Right now, I'm standing with Laurie's rescue team on the edge of Lake Murphy. It's dark and so cold. Standing with me is another long-time campaigner, David Evans.
David Andrew Evans.
From what I can gather, David is an expert on strategy.
We won't be going in straight away, as we don't want to scare the birds up into the guns. That strategy changes from year to year, depending on what's going on.
It's not a simple matter of getting onto the wetlands and shooing away the birds, like I thought. It depends on the size of the lake, apparently, and also the location.
Right now, you've got two wetlands that are full of shooters, and the only areas we're with water. And essentially, they'll be flying from one wetland to the next. So we want to keep it down as much as we can and only use our visual ploys when necessary.
Another important factor is the species of bird that lives here.
Some species will continue to fly around the wetland. Pink-eared ducks, freckled ducks, which are a threatened species, don't leave the wetland when they're disturbed. They'll fly low, and that's why so many get shot.
Unless you have the proper licences, you're not allowed on the water until 10 a.m. But shooting starts at sunrise, so rescuers will head out before then and face hefty fines and court dates if they're caught. Getting into the water is the easy part. Getting out again without running into a police officer is more complicated. It's even harder if you're carrying out dead or wounded birds. The likelihood of rescuers running into trouble on the water because of this is pretty high.
Police do have concerns that some of the hunters are a bit fired up, and so it's very important that we don't get engaged in any of that, all right? The onus is on you.
It's nearly 7 and it's getting easier to see, but the cold is still biting at my face. I weave in and out of rescue teams discussing their strategies and testing their walkie-talkies. A song is played over the loudspeaker to boost their spirits. When I start to hear distant cracks, it takes me quite a while to realise that this is the sound of shooting. Hunting season is open. The whole morning has had a militaristic feel to it. The strategising and the equipment even.
We went out and bought $25,000 worth of the best ballistic goggles we could get, which are the same as the Defence Force uses over in, you know, Afghanistan or Iraq.
Laurie made it clear when I first met him that for the rescuers, this fight is won on public perception, and utilising the media is a key part of that. Makes me wary of the ways the Coalition Against Duck Shooting try to frame the issue and what is taking place.
Our campaigns have always been media campaigns, and the power of the media to bring about social change is enormous. It's the most powerful weapon.
There are lines that I hear repeated by nearly every rescuer I speak to. One of the main ones is about empathy. It comes up again and again.
The brutality that's inflicted on those birds is just unacceptable. And the difference between duck shooters and rescuers is duck shooters have no empathy for their victims, and rescuers do have empathy for those birds.
At 8 a.m, an hour after shooting commences, Laurie gets arrested.
I got arrested over here.
Yeah.
For a $886 fine, banned for 3 months, and charged with obstruction. Four or five rescuers were coming off the water with a wounded bird, and a compliance officer was chasing them in a kayak, and he was yelling out for them to stop, and he was catching up to them, and if he had have caught them, he would have confiscated the wounded bird, he would have killed it. So as they went past, the kayak went past me, and I just grabbed the kayak. With all this violence and cruelty that happens out here, it's the rescuers who pay the price in court. And rescuers have been fined today $886, and a lot of them have been ordered off for 3 months. But, you know, we'll be back.
A little later in the morning, I meet Helen. She has a gaming license, so she's been kayaking around the lake, picking up the wounded birds and bringing them into the vet tent. I notice her by the shore in a heated conversation with a compliance officer and a policeman.
My birds were taken off me. There was discussion between the officers about what I was going to be charged with. I haven't been charged with anything because I was acting lawfully.
The guy trying to charge her wasn't a stranger to Helen. She sees him pretty much every year down here.
I got called in by Rod Carter, who is a compliance officer.
I started to ask Helen whether she'll be down here again for the whole hunting season, or just this weekend, but she cuts me off.
It's a shooting season, it's right. Not a hunting season.
Oh, okay. I make the same mistake again when I refer to what she's doing as a protest.
I'm not here to protest. Mm. I am here to rescue and to retrieve dead and injured birds.
Yeah.
The shooters like to refer to us as protesters.
Yeah.
But the point is, we're not here to protest. We're not holding up signs and banners. We are here to rescue, and we are here to witness.
Language is really important, especially in the battle for public opinion. It's important to Robert Kritzman too, who is on the other side of the issue.
You've been hunting here long?
Since 7:20 this morning, yes, but I've hunted most of my life.
There are a number of reasons why he shoots.
I first started, it was cultural. It started with my father and his father. I've been hunting for more than 50 years.
Shooters argue that actually they're part of the conservation solution.
I think we're certainly part of the conservation solution. You know, field and gun hunters have been for years planting nest boxes, we were the first to identify the fact that lakes have been dried out and swamps have been reclaimed. We've been doing this for 50 years actually, 50 years of reclaiming swamp lands. It just doesn't benefit just ducks, it benefits all wildlife. There's, ibises, coots and geese, swans, they're all continuously just existing because of field and game hunters.
As I walk around the lake to speak to more people, a fight breaks out.
Semi-automatics you never got. Semi-automatics you never got. You achieve nothing.
Which special store do you got? Which
There are times during the day when it's hard to tell whether this whole thing is a stunt or not. It's certainly what the shooters think, but is it what's happening? I ask Helen what's the worst part about being on the water.
It's the powerlessness. It's the suffering and the powerlessness that are the really painful things. Seeing birds being shot and hearing these men cry out in joy at inflicting pain on an animal is horrible. And the fact that they're so happy that they've hurt something, and it just makes me so angry with this government that they, and I really thought if we had a female for an agricultural minister that she would understand that this is male violence, and that they would put an end to this. I really thought Labor was something different, but they're not. They're just a paler shade of asshole. I think the ALP should rename themselves the Assistant Liberal Party.
Empathy. Is that what this all comes down to? Can you shoot a bird and also feel sorry for it?
Don't feel sorry for them. We're part of the food chain, and just as they are, taking a life is never a wonderful thing, but we eat meat. I enjoy the game, I enjoy the hunts, I enjoy the food on the table. Look, they're emotional. I can understand their perspective. I think they're misguided. I think they're emotional. There's no facts in their argument.
It's not the first time I've heard someone accused of making an argument on emotional grounds instead of a rational one. I wander back to the rescuers, wondering whether I should have gone harder on them. I asked Dave to refute Robert's accusation, but he says this instead.
Wounded birds are wounded birds, and to them, they're nothing. To us, it's a bird that actually feels, and it's filled with pellets. How can you... It's just seriously a lack of empathy on those blokes to have made such a comment like that.
By the end of opening weekend, the Coalition Against Duck Shooting collected the bodies of over 100 dead water birds. These include threatened species like the freckled duck. There's also a swan. Just like last year and the year before that, they lay them out on the ground before Parliament House and tell the assembled media that they will certainly be back next year.
That story was by Leona Hamid and was originally broadcast in 2015. Dive back into our archives to hear the full episode it comes from at allthebestradio.com. Thank you. You're listening to All the Best, and this week we're talking repeated collision. Baby teeth and cricket bats collide in this fiction piece from Zasha Rosen. But don't worry, it's not as graphic as it sounds.
The most important thing that Michael owned, apart from his collection, was his toy cricket bat. Most parents would give their children a plastic bat, but Michael's mum and dad were completists, and they'd very carefully looked for a replica Ashes cricket bat. But more importantly for Michael, it was made of some very hard wood. At 3 months of age, he'd first taken the bat in tentative fingers. His parents proudly told their friends that, "Oh, he just picks up anything, whatever he finds lying around." But in retrospect, it's more likely he was trying it for weight. He got his first teeth around 9 months. By 2, he had a full set. "They fall!" he asked his parents. "Not yet, sweetie," his parents replied, more than once, with the grinding anticipation that they could be spending the next 4 years on this question. And they did. They told him about the Tooth Fairy. The idea of a Tooth Fairy is pretty strange, really. It's a lot less strange if you're a parent trying to convince your child not to cry, but there are definitely some notes on it. Not least, there's the breaking and entering, and the questionable economics of enamel as currency. Michael took straight to it. He dreamed of it. Most people get nightmares about their teeth falling out. For most, it's some creeping angst about death, or those million bodily processes that go to war with you under the skin. Those things that creep year by year and crawl like worms inside, those organs in their vast web of intervascular space, lymph and gristle, all of it waiting, waiting to turn over, churn and ferment. Yellow rotted teeth that fall to the pillow. Blood that spits teeth in the sink. Molars crumbled over your breakfast, sprinkled in with the kiwi fruit and the strawberry. In dreams, Michael birthed molars. By day, he forgot. By day, none of it bothered him. He was in it for the money. Michael calculated how many trains he could buy with how much tooth, and he had a plan. His plan would keep him solvent in trains for most of his single-digit years. He planned a layout, and stations, and the little people who looked like Swiss tourists. About 6, his first tooth came out, right on schedule. His parents were surprised, but not bothered. "It was in the back," he said. And they couldn't see, really, but they trusted. It wasn't his, really. It was cricket. He'd been playing super close cricket with Joe from down the street, and as he raised the bat to hit the ball, bare centimetres from Joe's open hand, he quickly cracked into contact with Joe's mouth. This was inevitable, really, as the rules they'd invented meant you had to stand less than a metre apart and swing the bat no matter what. 2 of Joe's teeth came flying out, but Joe only ever found one. Michael had a tooth already wobbling, but the threads were keeping it stuck in place. Now he had Joe's tooth in his pocket. When Michael got home, he washed it and turned it over and over. He looked at the roots and the shine and all the gentle wear of 4 years' bite, nibble and grind. In his mind, he converted it into coin. When he slid it under his pillow, the Tooth Fairy gave him $2 overnight. Not long after, his actual tooth fell out. That earned him another 2. Almost enough for a Swiss tourist, though there were no more wobbly teeth, not just yet. But Michael had always been a practical child. He took his bat to the back lot where the other kids played cricket. "Let's play super close cricket," he screamed. They didn't want to. Many of them had seen Joe, and most of them were smarter than that. But Michael had his bat. And there were 2 kids with 4 less teeth. Michael had his little bag, and he started counting up for a station. "Next week," he said, "bring some new kids." His parents were getting suspicious. But for them to have really cottoned on, they'd have needed to imagine a 6-year-old child committing assault with a cricket bat. And they were his parents. Suspicions weren't the same as deductions, and 6-year-olds are already pretty weird. Anyway, he trickled the teeth out slowly. He kept the rest in a bag under his bed, filing baby molars and canines separately, filling with calcium candies that spotted blood, trailed strings of gum, and rattled when he shook them late at night. He had enough for some polystyrene to carve little mountains. He had enough for an engine. A caboose, if he was careful. Then Mary came to play. Her brother dragged her there, pleading through the gap in his teeth. Mary had been raised different. "You can't have my teeth," she told Michael. "Of course I can, you big stupid," he said, employing his wit. "Don't be stupid yourself, you big stupid," she said. One day, Michael would be taller than Mary. He'd be taller and stronger, maybe faster, maybe better at cricket too. But right now, Mary was a year older, and plenty bigger and smarter to boot. She grabbed at the bat in his hands and said, "No!" Michael wasn't quite sure what to do. It was his bat, but she had it now. But she had his teeth in her mouth, so he pulled and pushed, and for a moment he almost seemed to be about to push the bat in her face or something like that. But she pushed back, and she pushed back something wicked, and he never really stood much of a chance. Mary didn't know her own strength. Though, actually, it was more that Michael didn't know Mary's strength. The bat collided with the side of his face, and he fell on the ground, face on the floor. Teeth dribbled out of his face. Teeth were everywhere, spattered like dice rolled in dirt. Mary dropped the bat, looked at the teeth, and didn't seem quite sure what to do. So she picked out three ambivalently, put them in her pocket, and went home. "You big stupid," she said. The other kids followed. Michael waited until he stopped crying. He gathered up his teeth, picked up his bat, and walked home. He counted his teeth out, all 11. Each tooth was $2 apiece. That might be an engine. No carriages. "What have you got there?" asked Michael's mum, as he came into the kitchen. He smiled, opened his hand, and showed her. Even grown up, Michael sometimes dreams about the cheap upholstery in the psychologist's office, the plastic smell of the dentist's chair, about sad children with empty mouths, and about the games his parents wouldn't let him play. Things push out from inside him that he just doesn't let go anymore. No cricket, no trains, and no tooth fairy. It's been so long since he thought about any of them, actually. If he does, he pretends not to remember that shiver he got from converting tiny body parts of himself into coin. He scrubs himself clean every day. He's an adult now, concerned with adult things. He works with nice people, in a nice office. Clinical, bright, and bland like paper. He converts tiny parts of his soul into money, day by day. Sometimes he smiles to his colleagues. They're nice, and they smile back with their smiles, crooked or clean. And sometimes he smiles just to himself in the mirror. He has full rows of adult teeth, straightened by braces and whitened by science. He looks at his face, and he knows. He always knows. Some nights, he dreams, and he feels his teeth fall down perfectly out of his mouth and into his breakfast cereal, like strawberries. Then he smiles in his sleep, perfectly, to himself.
That story was written and produced by Zasha Rosen. We originally broadcast this story in 2015. That's it for the show this week, but one last thing. For the past few weeks, we've been working on something that we're really excited to share with you. If you like what you hear on All the Best and you'll be in Sydney on the 9th of March, we're throwing a live listening and storytelling night. Come and join us in our Midnight Garden Theatre at 107 Projects in Redfern, where we'll be celebrating our new look and sound with an awesome lineup of contributors from Sydney and Melbourne sharing their nocturnal stories. Tickets are only $12 and you can buy them through trybooking.com. We'll be posting all the details on our website, allthebestradio.com, and on our Facebook page. So if you haven't already, give us a like and get all the details. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Bethany Atkinson-Quinton. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Tegan Nichols compiles our show. Beth Gibson is our SYN Production Manager. And I'm Jess Hamilton. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and also find our archives at allthebestradio.com. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.